have a tattoo of Metal Gear Solid on my body because I feel a bit iffy about it. It's like, so you're okay with that? And I'm like, no. It's like, well, then why is it branded on your skin? It's
like, I really like it, but no.
And then I don't want to pretend that it's a representation of how things you can love are difficult sometimes.
Yeah, or like, you know, for a tattoo, like, I don't have any tattoos. I'm not a big fan of the idea of modifying my own body. Everybody else, go crazy. It's your body.
Yep.
But yeah, if I was to get a tattoo, it would have to be a fairly succinct or like a sort of a metaphorical idea of something I'm trying to express.
Yeah.
And Metal Gear Solid probably wouldn't do that for me.
It's probably not a good one.
It'd be tough to think of a video game that does.
I tried. I sat down for... Honestly, sat down for 10 minutes, which is a lot for me because I'm a terrible person.
When you say 10 minutes, considering a tattoo, I'm sure that doesn't sound like very much at all.
That was just realistic.
Yeah.
Like, I was going to say hours, and then that would be a lie.
10 minutes was enough for me to know that.
Yeah, I think there was a moment where I was with my first girlfriend ever, and she was like, oh, you can get a tattoo, and then you can just cover it up with, like, airbrush something. There's, like, some spray you can get. That's, like, basically, like, spray tan or whatever. But... for whatever skin tone.
There's a lot of effort to go through every day if you're in a job that needs to cover it up.
The point was, though, that, like, you can get a tattoo. What will you get? And then I was like, oh, I can even buy the tattoo printable stuff that you can put in your printer and you can print your own tattoos.
Oh, cool.
Still couldn't think of a tattoo to get.
It's one of those things. There's simultaneously way too many options and also all of them fail, like, my basic litmus test for what I would need in a tattoo.
And you know what happens, right? You sit there in front of the computer Googling tattoos... and it's like, but I can't get any of these tattoos because I've already got some.
And all the ones that are cool, right? All of the ones that I look at and go, oh, that's actually kind of interesting, are very culturally appropriated, you know? Like, I really like Polynesian and sort of Pacific Islander tattoos, but I'm never going to get one. That would be really, really shitty of me.
I actually did come to a tattoo design, which was basically going to be like, if you've seen those Greek pots... with like,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to get one of those around my bicep with Hercules fighting the Hydra.
Yeah, that, I mean, like, that I feel like you're closely, like, because you have that heritage, that is what stops it from being shitty, right?
Right, and I'm like, I could probably do that, right? And then that if I'm going to get a tattoo, it's going to be that. But even then, I'm like, I can't be bothered.
Yeah.
I'd rather just put holes in my body with piercings. I'm just covered in them.
Even piercings for me are a bit much, like...
The piercings I got pierced... we're just going to talk about body modifications now.
Yeah.
Well, I got piercings in my right ear because it was a childhood fantasy of mine to have ponytail and piercings. And I achieved both of those in 2016.
Bucket list tick.
Yeah. I won't be a priest in the military, but hey, you got to pick your battles, right? But I got these three piercings done at once, mostly because I'm a creep and into pain, but also because I always wanted them. And also because I could just take them out if... I want to get rid of them and they'll just grow over.
It's sort of easier to deal with those.
I took the risk that there will be no permanent damage. And so far,
It's like, even if there was, it's very, very minor. Like, I have scars from where I give blood. And when I first started giving blood and I realized that was a possibility, I was like, do I still want to do this? But very rapidly, I was like, totally worth it, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's complete... You know, every time I donate, I get a text message that tells me I just saved three people's lives. Probably worth a tiny scar and a part of a body that nobody looks at.
You're actually the reason that I started donating blood regularly.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because, you know, I the last time we donated blood together, I wussed out because I was feeling nervous.
To say you wussed out because you were feeling nervous very much undersells the whole situation there. Medical people were there to make sure everything was fine and stuff. So to say I wussed out because I was nervous makes it sound like you just didn't show up.
No, I was there, but I did ask the nurse to fail me, basically.
Oh, right.
So I think wussing out does apply. I think that's a great place to start.
Yeah. All right. So should I just jump on in as we usually do?
Yes, you should.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Slowpokes podcast. I am Slowpoke number 2, David Chalante.
And I'm Slowpoke number 1, John Nicolaitis.
And I forgot my rule about saying folks instead of ladies and gentlemen at the start of the podcast.
Whoopsie doodle, you pointed it out now, so everything's cool.
Yeah.
Yay.
Right. Real briefly on that, I'm trying.
Just like, trying is important, and recognizing when you make a mistake is also important. Just be nice.
Welcome, folks.
Yay.
Welcome, everyone.
Everyone. All
everyone
of you.
Everyone except Nazis. Welcome to the Slow Folks Podcast.
I think that's a safe one. Yeah. All right. Welcome to the show. We are here today to talk about the beginner's guide.
Yeah. I was a little bit concerned. Like, were you asking me to say at that time? Was I going to be on you?
Dave, I wanted to point at you. I just, like, you're the only one.
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to
Very few people do now.
Oh, no, I do it all the time. Even when you're not looking, I just point.
All right. Well, that makes me feel oddly comforted. So the Slowpokes podcast, for those of you who are joining us for the first time, is a show in which we discuss recent but not exactly current games that we didn't really get round to when they were current.
Yeah.
I kind of like thinking of it sort of like Oscar season. You see all of the movies and you're like, I'm going to watch all of those. Then you don't.
But then you do because of this show.
Yes, sort of. Exactly. But not so with- this show is basically about us making the time to play games that we felt that we should have played forever. Welcome for joining us to that. That wasn't a sentence.
It's okay. None of these sentences.
Yeah, no, but thank you for joining us for that, and I hope that you're excited for it.
I think we're kind of, it's like, for us, there's a moment where, like, we've done, like, a whole bunch of these, so we're kind of excited in general, and yeah. So that's why we're kind of having a moment here to go, yay!
Yeah! And, we're sort of really, things are really, really moving along production-wise as well, so I'm pretty psyched about all of that kind of stuff, but now we're doing that annoying thing where we talk about the production of the podcast on the podcast itself. We are talking today about The Beginner's Guide. That was released on October 1st, 2015, so a little over a year ago at this point, and it was very notably written by one of the co-creators of the Stanley Parable, Davey Reedon, I want to say that name is pronounced.
I would have no idea.
The full team size was sort of closer to 9 or 10 people, but yeah, he was the writer and one of the creative leads, and a lot of people think of it as his game. So normally at the start of these podcasts, we like to start with we have a bit of a structure going on. We talk about our expectations and start with a sort of a spoiler-free section.
You know, our hopes and dreams, what we feel.
Well, less the hopes and dreams and more like the spoiler-free section. Yeah. That's what I'm talking about right now.
Yeah, okay.
But with a game like The Beginner's Guide, that's kind of impossible because there's not really anything you can talk about in a game like this that isn't like a spoiler.
Yeah, I think that almost everything you get from this game is what you would call like text. It's all a part of the experience.
Yeah.
And it's just...
So that's the downside of the double-edged sword. The upside is... We can say this. It's fucking awesome.
Yeah.
Absolutely great game. Very short and relatively cheap. So if you do want to join us... Go play it.
Go play the game.
You'll finish it in one sitting.
Yep.
Couple and then hours. You can jump back and join us in the conversation.
Perfect.
Because the other thing that we should probably say as well is normally we try and at least accommodate people who haven't played the game before.
Yeah.
Again, it's not really possible with the beginner's guide. It's just way too dense.
Unless, you know, you wanted us to describe a visual and physical, like, you know, a game.
Paint you a word picture.
Yeah, if you want us to, you know, send us some money and we'll construct a word picture. But we cannot do it in a 1 hour podcast.
Yes, no, definitely not. So,
Nor should we.
We'll be focused, like, apologies to those of you who do like to sort of join us without having played the game. But yeah, we will be kind of proceeding from this point on as if you have played it, and we're going to be completely spoilered, like spoiler warning 100% from this point on.
Yeah.
So what else should we talk about as far as the beginner's guide at the start of the podcast?
I think it's very important, like you've mentioned that, yeah, you can't really talk about this game, and because of that we're kind of abandoning our very loose sort of way we talk about these games.
Yeah, of course, yeah.
We're going to really... me and David sat down and we sort of talked about ideas of how to structure this. Again, not to get too deep.
So rather than focusing on like sort of artistic areas of game design, like we sometimes like to do, we're basically just going to go through sort of theme by theme. Like the themes that we think the game's trying to explore and talk about how we felt about them, what parts of the game sort of spoke to us in regards to those themes, and that kind of a shape to it. We're not here to draw any conclusions. This isn't an essay. As much as I could write probably like 6 essays on this.
David, I signed up to provide definitive 1 hour long solutions for everything. After games, we were going to do the constitution.
If you want the answers... You come to David John.
Yeah.
You come to the fucking Slowpokes.
That's what I want our name to be. The Truth, capital T. Obviously, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, we're basically InfoWars. You don't know what InfoWars is, do you?
Is it the silence? Was it the silence that gave it away?
Well, let's just say that you wouldn't like InfoWars and leave it at that. All right, so, yeah, so let's maybe talk about some of our expectations.
Cool. So one of the things we do normally talk about before we start the podcast is who played it, who hasn't, who's coming to the experience brand new. I actually played this game, not when it came out, but a couple, sometime last year. I can't remember exactly when.
2016, just so everyone's clear.
2016, with my good friend and reoccurring side character, Ollie, who will occasionally come up because we play a lot of games together.
Yeah.
Because reasons.
The legend of Ollie is probably growing in the mind of our listeners.
The legend of Ollie! but we played through this game together as like a joint experience, because we do that, and it was very interesting. But I did have the expectation going into it that you can't, no spoilers, no one can talk about this.
Yeah, because there was a lot of like discussion about like, is this the kind of game that even can be critiqued?
Yeah.
That wasn't something I really learned about until after I played it, basically. Like, I mean, I only played this, just to be clear, I only played this at like, I finished it at like 2 a.m. last night.
Yeah.
But obviously, John and I have had a couple of conversations. That was one of the things that sort of, it doesn't surprise me at all that people were talking about it like that.
I mean, we literally,
but I luckily didn't go into it with that, because I feel like that's a really shitty way to go into a product. It's like, oh yeah, you can't think about it.
But that's not really what I was saying. But yeah, like someone telling you not to think about something when you go into it, it's like, well, do you want me to just vegetate?
More along the lines of like, oh, to critique this game is like making fun of a clown.
Ooh.
You know what I mean? Like, one of the themes that we're talking about here is like, is it fair to critique games? Is one of the themes we feel this game examines. And so when you're critiquing a game that says the critique of games may not be a good thing, it's kind of like trying to make fun of a clown in my mind. Like, like, what are you going to say? He's got a dumb nose and some stupidly big shoes.
Look at
like,
him fall over. Clown. What a dumb clown. Yeah. Okay. I get what you mean.
And so, like, when you're sitting here, it's like, oh, should we critically analyze this game that talks about the critical analysis of games? Is that something that's even possible? You know?
I think this is something that comes down to, like, where you personally sit with something. Because I feel like there are some people who will say some art is above reproach.
Yeah.
And I'm going to call this game art a lot. So.
I don't think art is above reproach.
Yeah, I also agree with you.
Yeah. Just as, again, sort of priming you guys for the podcast, one of the other things that we should mention as well is that there is another... one of the big things people talk about is whether or not the character of Coda in the game is real. Like, the premise that's sort of presented is real, that Coda is a real person who made some real games, and the Beginner's Guide really is just the repackaging of those games.
And it's a non-fiction piece.
It's a non-fiction piece, basically. Nope.
No, I think Coda is clearly a narrative device.
Yeah, and I think that like they give you clues at that from minute one of the game. So we're not going to entertain that idea. I'm sure there's thousands of people have already talked about that. We feel like that's a bit of a waste of time.
Yeah, there are other places to go to discuss that. We're just not going to do it here, FYI. We're going to talk about Coda as part of the work. Mm-hmm.
Because this is also a super complex game, we'll just clarify some of the framework we're using to break it down.
Yes.
So Davey Redden was the writer and the designer of the game.
Yes.
And he plays himself as a character in the game. So in order to distinguish the real person from the character, we're going to be referring to the character as the narrator.
Yep. So whenever you hear us say the narrator, we're talking about the character of Davey in the game.
Yeah, as it's presented, regardless of how much overlap there might be with the real person.
Yes.
Something else that's worth mentioning is the game sort of operates on three levels. Again, we're assuming you've all played it, so you know that. You've got the games of Coda unedited, sort of being analyzed as the way the narrator is analyzing them. That's sort of level one. Above that, you have the narrator themselves and their influence over the game and how you experience it. That's level two.
Yep.
And then the third level is the beginner's guide as a game that I actually own being sold on Steam. And we're planning on spending most of our time talking about level three.
Yeah.
Right? Presuming that everything sort of beneath that is designed and deliberately fictionally designed.
Yeah. And I feel like the game does a great job of presenting itself. And it's a very short, lovely experience that you can just jump right into. I say lovely. Not everyone thought it was lovely. Some people found it challenging. We'll get into that later.
Yeah. And even though I think it's lovely, I also think it is challenging.
Yes. No, neither excludes each other.
Yeah.
But that's very important, you know, the way we're going to discuss the names and the way we're going to talk about the game. And we're going to really just start going through sort of these themes that really we feel are in the game. It's a way to talk about what we experience.
Yeah. So we'll stop talking about how we're going to talk and start doing it now.
Sure. We got like 45 minutes or so. Okay. Jokes aside, we'll just go right into it.
All right.
It.
So I think the first one that we should talk about, I feel like this is the primary theme of the game, is whether or not art requires an audience to be art.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think this is a really interesting idea, because The game sort of has Coda and the narrator debating whether or not an audience is a crucial part of something.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting when we talk about games, like a lot of people would say, is it a game if it doesn't have a player? We don't necessarily apply that same metric to other forms of art.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so if you have, like, if I was just to write for myself,
like a diary, for
like instance. A diary or a journal, or, you know, even if I do creative writing for myself, it's not weird that I do that just for me and don't show that to anyone. That's not considered damaged, right?
No.
Dance is probably another really big one. Lots of people love to dance in private.
Yeah.
And nobody would say that they're suppressing themselves necessarily by doing that.
All the time in this room. Yeah.
No, the only time I dance is when I'm alone. Yeah. I'm not a big dancer in public. And I don't think that's because I'm like embarrassed or anything. It's just that that's the avenues in which I decide to express myself in that way.
Yeah. I think the game really does reinforce this by the way that Coda just makes these games and kind of always just makes them for himself. Mm. In terms of how when I played through the game, the experience I kind of got was Coda would share the games, but it wasn't as, like, that wasn't the focus to me of the interpretation. I don't know how weird. But when you hear about the narrator sort of talk about the experience, it's like sometimes he had to cajole, other times he was sent the games, but it was always really irregular and it was always feels very personal.
Yeah, and that's the thing that I think it's being explored a lot of the time. It's like you have the narrator presenting the games to us, the player.
Yeah.
And they constantly reference how those games have been changed by the narrator to make them playable and to make them experiential and something that like is capable of being translated to what the player expects.
Oh yeah.
I think that it's really, really interesting that like that question of whether a game does need a player or if it can exist something like a journal where it can be something that is an avenue of self-expression or an avenue of self, perhaps exploration is a better way to put that.
Yeah. There's several moments, there's several games that are presented to you because the game itself, The Beginner's Guide, is a sequence of games designed by Coda.
Yeah.
And several of them have been redesigned by the narrator to be finished.
Yeah, exactly. And like, so those links are made. And I think that it makes an... I think that, like, that core question of, like, is this still art if the only person who knows it is its author?
Hmm.
I think is an interesting question. I personally would say yes. I remember when I was studying poetry at uni, the tutor... I wish I could remember the name of the theorist that they gave. But they talked about this theorist who would try to define things by subtraction. So they asked, you know, what is the minimum thing that you need for theatre to be theatre? Do you need lighting? No. Do you need a set? No. Do you need a stage? No. And basically, like, the, you know, you boil it all down. It's like, so do you basically need a performer and an audience member? And I remember having, again, this conversation with Ollie, and Ollie was like, do you need an audience member, though?
Mm.
And it's a very interesting question about, like...
There's an idea that the creator it's themselves can be the audience, especially if the work is... My brain wants to draw the parallels between, like, exercise and, like, going for runs and then you go for a race.
But it's also that really, because you mentioned, like, the author can be the audience. So many of the games as presented by Coda have that theme of talking to oneself as part of it, you know? Mm. So you've got the prison game where it ultimately ends with the final version of the prison game is Coda having a conversation with himself over the phone.
Yeah.
You have the house game where you've got the character that you're playing having a conversation with the other house cleaner. And so I feel like that is exploring that idea that, in fact, you know, the author can be the intended audience, that it can be a productive form of expression and exploration if only that person is part of it.
Mm. No, I would agree with that. I mean, from... I think that personally is like when you self-create, there's a lot that can be learned from this experience.
Mm,
There's a lot to learn when you just sit there and force yourself to create or whether you jump to create and what you do and how you spend your time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the game itself really is just this big collection of these little self-expressions of Coda.
Because we've all done that, right? Yeah. We've all had little sketches that we've made. We've all, you know, like I've built websites just to learn HTML for a bit of fun.
I mean,
and I think that what muddies it when you come to games and like, because when you talk about games, I hate bringing back up these dichotomies, but you have sort of like the industry of game making and the art of game making.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so when we think about writing, we almost exclusively think about that as an art.
Yeah.
As like as the average person thinks of that as art, even though there is a part publishing industry. That's a real thing,
yeah,
right?
Totally.
And when we have games, I just think that like the industrial side of it is so much more obvious to us because it feels a lot like a technical construction.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what complicates some of that. It's like, well, if you make a Hollywood film, but then don't show it to any audiences, a lot of people think that was crazy, like ridiculously stupid.
Yeah.
But if I just make a little home film on my phone and chop it together in like Windows Movie Maker or whatever,
yeah,
no one's going to be surprised if I say, yeah, I never intended to show that to anyone.
Yeah, of course.
And I think that's where we fall to this trap with games, right? Like, it feels so much more like the Hollywood industry side of an artistic endeavor than the artsy art side of that endeavor.
This is why people always talk, in my opinion, this is why the people always talk about the idea of the indie scene being important, revitalizing that. Because in a way, it's a way for the gaming industry at a whole to return to the camcorders at home roots that it kind of moves away. And that's why game jams are a thing. And that's why that movement exists.
And, you know, it's because of that kind of push that we luckily have games like the Stanley Parable very and stuff true. Like that. So it's very much worth high-fiving.
But because a lot of the industry came from like, originally it came from these, you know, creators and people. Mm. My father used to code his own games. You wanted to play a game, you had to make it yourself, right? Some of the really early days, that's what you did. And the aggressive industrialization, commercialization of games has kind of the Hollywood-ish,
a bigger industry than film now, I think.
You know, that being said, I'm not trying to hide over places like Newgrounds, like Flash Games. Like, there's a whole cultural movement of people making their own games. And I'm not saying that didn't happen. I'm just saying in, like, popular culture and a lot of people, it's very much just like products selling business stuff.
Mm.
And personally, I would create just terrible, terrible games in like StarCraft editors that were nothing but just me poking fun.
Yeah, and so we come right back to it, right? Like, we all do this. Yeah. Like, everyone has fucked around in a Source engine. Everybody's fucked around in Warcraft 3 editor. Like, everyone's tried to whip up a level in Portal 2. You know, we've all done it somewhere.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really interesting that like the games of Coda made us like standalone things. We're kind of like, why aren't you showing this to anyone? Why aren't you trying to publish? Why aren't you trying to enter that commercial space? Yeah. It's a really interesting question. One of the other things I think is interesting about whether or not art requires an audience is I feel like another one of the themes the game explores is the entitlement of fans. And you get this in different places. So this is a different question.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't so much about can art exist without an audience.
Yeah.
It's more that like there are definitely parts of the game where you see, I feel like, the pressure of like public opinion or whatever coming through and affecting that. And the biggest one with that is the machine section where you've got the machine that represents Coda imprisoned and you have the people angry at it for not creating the good games and only creating the poisoned game.
Yeah. I think that's an element that the narrator really brings to the experience itself, how they're always talking about. The narrator really takes the games personally and becomes really invested in what they're trying to say and the experience of them.
And so it's not just like those scenes where you have the masses. You also got the narrator the whole time as constantly like this very entitled fan.
Yeah.
Kind of pushing Coda to make the games that the way he wants them to be made. And, you know, immediately you get people like George R.R. Martin that jump to mind where people are like, finish Game of Thrones before you die because I deserve it, and how like fucked up that is to say to a person.
That's intense. I imagine someone distilling your entire life into a single creative work that you've done and said, if you don't finish it, your life is pointless.
Yeah, it's also an interesting theme to talk about now. I don't want to sound like a baby boomer here, but the internet changed everything.
oh boy, whiz bang!
Like, you think about something, a huge cultural phenomenon like the Beatles, right? And obviously the Beatles had a lot of really, really rabid fans, but they didn't have fandoms like we have now. Those groups of fans didn't have the same access to the creators, and they didn't have the same access to one another that creates what we call a fandom now.
A great way to talk about the internet, in my opinion, is like a catalyst.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
These reactions, the way people behave, fandom itself, like you said, they always happen. The Beatles is a perfect example, right? But the internet acts like a catalyst, and a catalyst in chemistry is something that accelerates a process, which in this case is like hyper involvement and obsession.
Just like that intensity of it. And it's not just the intensity of it, but how visible that intensity is to the creator.
Oh, yeah.
I think that this game definitely explores that idea. Like I said at the start, it feels like we're just pointing to a bunch of questions without providing any answers. We're not supposed to. But do you think that that idea that the intensity of fans at some point, you think that influences that kind of concept of whether or not a game needs an audience, or is it perhaps negatively affected by having an audience?
I think that I've experienced games and external to this that I feel like elements were added that were unnecessary,
yeah,
but were added to either please fans or to meet benchmarks, yeah, that games should reach.
Yeah,
I think there's a game called That Dragon Cancer where there are segments in that one could argue feel like they were added
just because they didn't want to be accused of not being a game. Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like there's a lot of reaction to culture that can be very difficult,
yeah,
for a creator to
especially, deal with. As we've already said, by a profit-driven industry, that can be really tough. And you can think about, like, you know, the addition of microtransactions to a game as being something similar to that. It's about not just, like, the audience influence, but the commercial influence over that, and whether or not a game is purer if it's completely divorced from those other things. I think one of the really interesting points in the Beginner's Guide that discusses this is when the narrator's talking about the argument he has with Coda about that concept. And so Coda sends him a folder full of playable games,
yeah,
which is just 100 box rooms, basically, that you can walk around in.
Yeah.
And nothing happens and nothing changes. And what I think is really interesting about that conceit is that, like, you get this real sense of being constrained by it, that, like, these playable games, quote-unquote playable games, you can do what a player would expect of a typical game, move around, walk around, look at what you want to look at,
yeah,
but nothing grows, nothing is produced from it. It's just very trapped.
Yeah, and it should also be said that the narrator plays all of them,
yeah,
just to see if anything happens, which is the idea of obsession in trying to find ideas that might not be there. It's like missing the point of the whole experience. Coda presents that zip file of hundreds of games that are just boxed rooms.
Yeah.
As like, yeah, you're supposed to play a couple of these and go, oh, there's nothing here. The narrator doesn't. He plays every single one.
Yeah.
Just to check.
Yeah. But I also feel like, I mean, we're getting a little bit deep into the level two stuff here, but what's interesting about that, I think, is more the point being made rather than the narrator reaction to it. One of the other things that's kind of interesting to talk about when it comes to the critical analysis of games, which the Beginner's Guide, you know, again, big theme is sort of like the audience interpretation of something. There's that discussion of, like, the author is dead, right? And so just for very briefly for anybody who doesn't know what that means, it's the idea that when you approach a piece of art, you should remove the author from the equation of your analysis. So you only think about what the finished work does in relation to its audience rather than what the author's intent might have been, or the author's personal motivations might have been, or what they were going through, if they were stressed at the time and how that affected the work. The author is dead question, I think, is also very uniquely interesting in games, once again, because the industry side of that is very obvious to us.
Yeah.
So it's very, very difficult to divorce a game like Assassin's Creed from Ubisoft, you know, because it's Assassin's Creed, it exists in a series. We can see that, like, it's like their flagship product that they call, you know, their iconic thing. Whereas with a film, it's a little bit easier to do. And once again, with like a novel or a play from the 1600s, aka Shakespeare,
yeah,
easier to do once again. How do you feel about that? How do you feel like the Beginner's Guide kind of explores that?
To me, the Beginner's Guide explores the idea of the author being dead. It's like, wow, I just said your question back at me. That's the real sign that someone's struggling with an answer. It's tough, right? So right now, I'm just going to break form because this game is very difficult to talk about. So
yeah.
I'm going to have to take a personal moment and just be like, man, it is a dense material.
Yeah, and I was going to say this at the start of the podcast, and I'll probably repeat it later just in case we cut this bit out. But I feel like the Stanley Parable and this, they ask really specific questions but don't give any specific answers.
Yeah.
I mean, just because they are open-ended and open to interpretation doesn't mean that the questions that they're asking aren't explicit and clear.
Yeah.
And that's what I think makes talking about this a little bit difficult, because it's not completely open to interpretation. You've got that idea that, you know, it's raising questions about the author being dead, about audience entitlement to games and that kind of thing.
And it does it. I think this game asks questions really well.
Yeah.
So it'll set up these games and it'll use the narrator and the discussion with Coda to help bring up these ideas.
Yeah.
I mean, like, in terms of talking about the previous topic, because good lawyer to start talking about something, the idea of, like, entitlements of fans and things like that, there's a game that is constructed by Coda that kind of illustrates the idea of feeling uncertain about talking to a creator and then being trapped by that. It was just a stage game.
Yeah. I really love that one.
Yeah. And, like, again, I don't want to talk about how beautiful these games are.
Yeah.
But the game kind of asks these questions through these vignettes. And, man, it is just a game of questions. And I think that's a beautiful thing, because I think art is supposed to provoke questions, right? And that's what this game does really well.
Yeah, definitely.
And again, it's not a very useful thing to throw in the middle, but I think sometimes you just, especially, and I'm just going to talk about it now because fuck it. One of the things that happened with a lot of the people who sort of reviewed this game and discussed it, and what I'm literally doing right now,
yeah,
in the middle of our podcast recording, is they went into personal diatribes and they discussed themselves and the emotions that came up. And I think that's because when you have to grapple with a bunch of questions with no answers,
yeah, you kind of hold on to what you do know, which is your certainty in the environment. I think Memento, the Christopher Nolan film Memento, makes that point that, like, he has a lot of uncertainty in his life, but he knows what an ashtray feels like when he picks it up. You know, they're asking a lot of big questions about being a critic and why can games be critiqued. I'm going to talk about why I'm a critic.
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of only the only place you can go with that.
No, totally. And I think that's why it's reflected in literally almost not...
It's not everything. There are plenty of games that just break this down straight analytically, but it is overrepresented in this game compared to, like, a review of COD. People don't generally ask themselves about whether or not the undertaking is worthwhile or meaningful when they're reviewing COD.
Yes, totally. I am super impressed by the way the narrator sort of leads you through this game.
Yeah.
It's just like a narrative device. It's so good.
Yeah.
The way he, like, intentionally is obtuse to, like, different interpretations. Everything, I feel like the narrator always feels like what he says is gospel.
Yeah.
And he doesn't take into regard that you could have different opinions to him.
Yeah, exactly.
And he, throughout the game, he always draws parallels to, like, your reactions to physical things that you do.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, you did that, I had that same experience. And then because he feels like he has a connection to you, he assumes that you will make all the leaps he does.
Yeah, and that's one of the other interesting things, is, like, that idea of the observer effect, right? Like, when you isolate a piece of art and don't have any audience to it, then all it is what the creator intends it to be. But the second you start exposing it to other people, subjectivity becomes a factor.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a really big theme in this game. And the question is sort of like whether or not that's worthwhile, what extent is that? And that's explored with the narrator doing that, right? So the narrator's going through and talking about his interpretation. And you, at least when I was playing it, I twigged very early on to be very careful about listening to him. Like, there's that point where he's explaining the puzzle, the two-door puzzle.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm going to tell you my interpretation of this. And I, a bit later down the track. And when he said that to me, I was like, okay, I need to know what I think first.
Yeah.
Because if I let him tell me before I come up with my own opinion, that'll be the only thing I hear.
Yeah.
So it does this in a lot of different ways. Like, you go into different the games that Coda has, and the narrator does things to, like, okay, you were supposed to be stuck in this part for an hour. I'll hit enter and I'll let you out now. All of that is that exploration of the idea that the audience and the observer influences how something is perceived.
Yeah.
You know, I think that, like, the power of the narrator and the narrator's relationship with the games is all just about exploring that question. Like, what does an audience inflict onto art they observe?
My only problem, to call it one, to even phrase it that way, good Lord, is that because of how the narration is set up, if you're not ready to be what I would call active thinker, you won't notice until it's a long way down the track that this kind of brain soak is occurring.
Yeah, but this is another thing that I ran into, right? Because I've mentioned this already. I feel like the beginner's guide for all of the big questions it asks, it isn't as subtle as I was expecting it to be.
Yeah.
The Stanley Parable has this same thing as well. They use subtler techniques like dramatic irony to make their points. It's not beating you over the head with a baseball bat, but I feel that all of the points it's making are designed to be picked up by most people who play it.
True.
So you're talking about going into this situation, if you're not ready to be an active thinker, that might catch you off guard. You might find yourself being influenced. I don't think that erodes the point. And I think that by the end of the game, everything has come out. You know what I mean? Like, it is clear that this is designed to be a game that causes you to ask questions about game design and about what your expectations are of game developers and things like that. So I can understand where you're coming from, that like a person who was going to this less critically would probably take longer to pick up on that kind of stuff.
No.
I don't think that
detracts
alters the core themes of the game to that player.
Playing through this game a second time,
it's like
a weird dissonance in expecting things to occur and then giving you space to think about things differently and like ignore the narrator, because good Lord, it's hard to ignore him because he talks constantly and loudly.
Mm.
And he never leaves you alone almost until it's intentionally done.
And there are really big moments that I noticed. I have this problem with Let's Plays and stuff in general. If I'm watching a Let's Play of a scary game, I don't get scared.
Yeah.
Because it's a Let's Play of it. Another person's talking over the top of it and everything. There are moments where I felt like if the narrator hadn't been there, my experience, just him observing and voicing his observations affected what emotion I was feeling when I was looking at stuff. Stuff that was scary or unsettling or confusing wasn't, because he was there as that guiding rail.
Yeah.
And again, that's all so deliberate. And what's really fascinating about that is because I'm a huge fan of dramatic irony, right? Yeah. I'm a huge, huge fan of that technique of like operating on those two different levels and making something more meaningful because of the difference of knowledge you have as the audience member. And I thought what was really interesting about this, the dramatic irony in this game, is it wasn't purely spoken. It was like you would be looking at the dissonance between what Coda was presenting and what the narrator was saying about it.
Yeah.
And then that's what was the generation of that dramatic irony.
Oh,
it was really interesting.
That is such a great point. I think it comes back, to me, it comes to the focus in the house experience.
Yeah.
You clean the house.
Yeah, yeah.
Because for me, when I was playing that, I was having such a beautiful moment there and I just wanted to soak into it. And the narrator's like, well, better move along. And you're just screaming at Davey.
The narrator, to be clear. Like,
to be clear, you're screaming at the narrator. You're saying, oh, good job, creator of this game. But the narrator, you're screaming at him. And he literally tears the walls off the house.
Yeah.
And I think that both speaks to what you were saying about the irony and also about how obvious the game is.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's one of the handful of changes they very explicitly point to once the twist is revealed.
Yeah.
So the adding of the lampposts and the alteration of the house game are the two ones they explicitly point to, but you don't know what other changes are the narrator and what parts of the game are purely what Coda intended in the first place.
Yeah.
I think that kind of brings up that idea of ownership of a creative work, which is another one of the big themes that we feel this game is discussing.
Totally.
There's that idea that, and this has been a big conversation with things like Let's Plays and what we're doing now, a podcast, reviews and stuff like that, where you'll observe or experience a piece, a work, a text, and then do something that is driven by that original work, but is theoretically different. So right now we're doing a podcast about this game. Mm-hmm. When people do a Let's Play, they're doing a commentary about a game. I feel like the Beginner's Guide asks that question of what is transformative, and is that transformation a good thing? Is it a noble thing? Is it a productive and creative thing? Or is it parasitic, you know? And you get that a lot because, like, very much on YouTube right now, you've got that whole people can content claim a video where, like, if you do a Let's Play of, like, a Nintendo game, Nintendo can claim the content of that and they get the monetization of it.
And they do it a lot.
Yeah. And so some places are cool about it, others aren't. But I feel like that idea of the narrator changing Coda's games and then presenting them to us is playing around with ideas like that. I don't think it's a direct criticism of Let's Plays or anything like that. I think it is, once again, asking a question without necessarily providing an answer.
I think the game itself, it bundles the narrator's presentation of Coda's games to others with his own set of personal insecurities. And I think that's what takes it away from being like a direct, like, it removes that kind of broad statement because it gives the narrator specific flaws that it can then use to leverage why he enacts things.
If this perhaps was obvious from the start of the podcast, both of us think the narrator is very unreliable.
Oh, yeah.
It goes without saying. When the end of the game says the narrator is unreliable, it's pretty safe to say the narrator is unreliable.
Totally.
That's not a suspicion.
And when you see things and the narrator describes them in a different way, you're just going, well, I don't know, man. And the narrator is definitely portrayed that way.
Yeah, and obviously you've mentioned the house, which is the most... I think that part of the reason that one was made explicit is because in Coda's original design, that was endless.
Yes.
In the narrator's change, it's not endless. It does end. And his point is that you can't stay in the comfortable place forever. You need to move forward. But that wasn't Coda's original game.
Yep.
So the entire message and the entire theme of that micro game is altered by that one change. And I think that... like, it's so hard to know what the original intent of any of those games are because of that. It's really fascinating.
And that's, I think that's why a lot of people are disappointed that they can't play the games in their quote-unquote original form, the way Coda intended.
Yeah.
Right, which, of course, isn't real.
And also, once again, we're getting back to that whole meta thing of, like, when people are saying, I would have liked to have played these Coda games unedited, what they're saying is to the real-life creators, would you please adjust this game so that it suits my standards, just as the narrator said to Coda. And was like, we're just cycles upon cycles upon cycles. That's why this game is so hard to talk about.
That's so good. I didn't even think about that. What a beautiful construct. It's like getting people to, that's very interesting choice. And explains why they haven't released these games as standalones.
I don't think you could, right? No. It destroys the ambiguity of it. I mean, again, the real life developers of this game have very notably declined to comment on it and make broad statements about the point of the game, which I think is obvious. Like, how could you make something like this and then want to give everyone the answer to it? It's just, I don't understand how anybody could even ask that question and expect an answer.
Wouldn't it completely just make the work pointless?
Yeah, exactly. It just completely undermines it.
It's like, why set up a whole bunch of open-ended questions and then give specific answers?
So I think that, that narrator basically is meant to be a parallel for the publisher's influence in a game before it reaches release, to be like the let's player and all that kind of thing. And even though, so we were talking very briefly about the Podquisitions read of this, and I'm trusting you with this because I haven't listened to this episode, but you basically said that you felt that at least Jim Sterling thought that it had an anti-critic message.
From my personal read of a podcast I listened to months ago, I did feel that Laura Dale and Jim Sterling kind of were making this point that the game was critiquing critics a bit more specifically. And I kind of feel like that's people taking their personal experience.
And I think that they're, especially when you are someone like Jim Sterling, who's been sued, what, 3 times now?
A lot. That's a lot of times.
We're both big fans of both Jim and Laura. So we want to make sure that we're not sounding, what's the word I'm looking for? Pejorative here, I guess? Or
I don't know words. You're the ones who knows words.
I don't want to sound like we're telling them they're doing things wrong. Basically.
Good Lord, no.
but yeah, I disagree.
With that.
I think that I'm going to say it a third time. The game asks questions. It doesn't give answers. And when it comes to specifically that idea about audience interpretation or critical interpretation of a game, it's not saying that the process is futile. I think it's just outlining the dangers and the pitfalls of the process and ask and make causing us, like, as we are now, we are ultimately also critiquing this game and analyzing this game, to think about how we do it and how we approach it.
Yeah, I think that the narrator is the tool that helps explore that. When you sort of get the impression that the reason why he's sharing these games isn't to be like, look at these beautiful things.
Yeah.
Aren't they lovely? What a gorgeous thing. I hope you enjoyed it. Goodbye. He's putting this story and narrative, and he's getting personally invested and personally involved, and it's dripping, it's overflowing with his desires and interpretations.
We're coming sort of back to that idea of, like, the fan entitlement and the ownership together. Like, the there's that sense that, like, fans own a part of a work by being fans of it, you know? And I think that that comes through a lot with the narrator as well, that, like, he talks about, like, that vicarious sort of praise,
feeling, yeah,
that
joy.
That joy that he gets for being able to share Coda's games. Like, oh, I discovered this. And I'm reminded...
A sharing that he does without Coda's consent.
Or even knowledge, you know? And I'm reminded of, this is such a tangent, we might cut this out, but the new Harry Potter book that came out a little while ago, a day after it was released, someone on my Facebook page spoiled part of it. And they were like, I can't believe no one's talking about this spoiler yet, let me talk about it. And I see that.
Oh, David, why'd you spoil it right here? Oh.
But, you know, I see that, and I don't see somebody who is genuinely trying to share the work. I see somebody who's trying to be seen as being a fan of the work.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when I look at that person and they're like, hey, I'm going to wreck this for you.
Yeah.
Because I've read it already. I have the knowledge. Yeah. I feel like there's stuff with the narrator that plays around with that as well, that the narrator is driven by a desire to be seen as having accessed this cool secret thing before you have. And how that can, once again, like how that can affect the interpretation of a work when it's filtered through people who propagate it rather than presented without comment. You know, yeah. And without that desire and that need to make yourself a part of it.
No, that's true. And that's a very personal thing because it ties into people's identity.
Yeah.
And I think that it's when people start to, in a sense, the way the narrator does it is the narrator is co-opting Coder's games
definitely.
To express his own identity. Yeah. And when Coder stops making games, he can't express himself.
Yeah.
And he feels frustrated. And so he makes this compilation. And
that's something, just very briefly back on the critical thing as well. I think that the game is ultimately sympathetic to all the people it depicts.
Yeah.
It does humanize all of them. There is no clear villain, but I interrupted you there.
No, I think what you said is very important. Even Coda himself understands this.
Yeah.
And while he does, he literally writes a letter into the last game he sends Davey.
Yeah. The narrator.
The narrator.
Yeah.
Did it twice. Naughty boy. But he literally writes a letter to the narrator in a game.
Yeah.
Right? And when you read that letter, there's again, it's very open-ended. There's a lot of interpretations, but I feel like there's still a desire from Coda for the narrator to learn something and to grow.
Yeah.
But you don't necessarily have to share it with me. You know, Coda is kind of like saying to the narrator, look, there's something you may have to look into yourself and find, right?
Yeah.
But when you find it, don't say it.
And it's really interesting, that last point as well, because like, I said the last point in the game, because it isn't just like a little bit of anxiety. Like, I really got the sense that the relationship between the narrator and Coda was like emotionally abusive. Like, he's talking about how I feel physically ill when you're around and this kind of thing.
Yes.
And there's, like, I can certainly see why people would feel that that makes the narrator the villain, right? Yeah. But I don't know how deeply to read that kind of thing. And it's like, at this point, is everything breaking down? Are we looking at we're looking at this game, right, that is apparently from Coda to the narrator, but is that still being filtered by the narrator? Like, are these some of the anxieties, are some of these messages like self-directed because of his own anxieties and his own fear about how Coda thinks of him? It's really fucking complex.
Yeah.
And it's almost impossible to boil down to any kind of concrete flaw. I think it's really interesting as well, just while we're on the subject, because we are doing real well for time, considering how complex this game is.
We're jumping all over the place, and there's that timer is... I trust it as much as I trust the narrator in this game, okay? So,
but
it's going to be an editing nightmare.
Yeah, I rise to the challenge.
Oh, yes.
I think it's really interesting as well that, you know, you start off the game with the narrator giving a contact email address to be like, share your interpretations with me here.
Yeah.
Because it's like... why? And I'm talking about real life Davey Raiden now. Why? Why invite that? It's so, like, other than curiosity, I can't figure out why he would say to players like me, give me your answer. Tell me what you think of this game.
Do you think that's a real email address?
I reckon it's a real email address.
Because there was a part of me that thought it was just a narrative device to kind of like say that this
to characterize the narrator as someone who wants that answer,
and also like to make it kind of like the work itself is autobiographical by but now
part of that that initial illusion that you're looking at something non-fictional. And
but if we're going to go into what I've read, the very brief stuff of Davey, the actual creator, and some of his struggles with depression and work, it'd be interesting for him to invite any kind of contact. That's a great point that you make. It's like, whoa, boy, do you really want a whole bunch of people emailing you?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Maybe those emails just go to a mailbox that never gets read.
I think something like, because we've just, again, we've committed one of the, we've entered into behavior that the game examines here.
Cardinal sins of the game.
Yeah, it's to say that they're sins of the game is rough.
Because, no, again, we must I whip don't ourselves. Think
they're explicitly criticized or demonized. But, I mean, you've spoken about the real life creator and potential mental health issues that he might have that have would influence decisions he's made regarding this game.
Yeah.
That kind of brings us back to that whole author is dead situation and the armchair sort of psychoanalysis that some fans engage in when they look at works. It's like, oh, this person was clearly depressed, or this person clearly had X or clearly had Y. And the way we build these ideas of an artist based on their work, like yeah. we have this idea of a particular person being affable and friendly because they're an actor in a movie where they always play affable and friendly characters. Or in a game, like, or basically what the narrator does with Coda, where he puts him on this huge pedestal as this like tortured but brilliant auteur.
Yeah.
When theoretically, Coda could just be some dude who likes fucking around in the Source Engine, you know? Like,
I was reading an article and it was discussing the idea of how the author of that article knew people who made games.
Yeah. Right?
And they could see how this person that they knew
yeah.
created this game. And they go, oh, see all these parallels and these links?
Yeah.
But when you go from a game and don't know the person, that's just infinite. Like,
even
just-
then, like, I've written poetry for and short works of fiction and stuff for uni, yeah? Like, specifically for uni where you get it assessed. And I've had people who I'm friends with and who they certainly feel, you know, we do share a great sort of intimacy, look at something I've written and then say to me, oh, I can see why this is this and this is that. And I'm like, really? Like, you went, like, it's not just that they said, oh, I read it this way. They've gone, oh, I can see that you did this so that it was read this way. And I'm like, for example, psychoanalysis. Psychoanalysis is an awesome thing for actual mental health reasons. And
people and their mental health.
We've moved a very long way since Freud. It's a very important part of therapy and stuff today. I'm not a huge fan of Freudian and Lacanian readings of text. I think that that's a fucking waste of time, personally. Right. And I don't code my text with Jungian archetypes and shit like that. But so many people who do like those readings go, oh, I can see you're doing this. And this is because at this point in your life, you were thinking about this. And it's like, even when you know the person, like, it's a very, very, very dangerous minefield.
I think that's true. I think the sort of one of the, like, the, to me, the game is sort of saying, like, if you're going to be critical, it's be critical of your motivations.
Yeah. Right? And see, we're getting a little bit too heavy on our own personal feelings here, but my general approach to literary analysis is the author is dead. That's the fairest way I can feel about it. I also feel it's the most productive way because it doesn't matter.
In all honesty, that's how we present every one of these podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
Until this one where we're getting a bit messy. Yeah. But, like, we literally present them as
our relationship with the text. Yeah. And the thing is, when you're talking about, like, the social effect or the cultural effect of a work, it doesn't fucking matter if Shakespeare was a misogynist or if Shakespeare was gay, if the work is misogynist or potentially secretly homosexual. Like, yeah. That's what matters, is what the reader or the audience member experiences, because most people don't approach these things with a critical mindset. And I think that's very important for critics to bear in mind, is that most people experience art, they don't analyze art. Author is dead. That's my position.
Okay. Well, I mean, if we just go around getting rid of all the authors, then we'll be fine.
Basically, yeah.
We just literally need to remove them from the system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just take out that one piece. The rest of it will operate perfectly fine afterwards.
Genius.
We should start a TED Talk type situation about how we can fix the world.
Oh, boy. So gross.
We're getting very much at time. Did you want to briefly talk about any of the stuff that we didn't quite get a handle on?
Oh, let's be honest. This is a beautiful mess that I very much enjoyed. But to claim I understand what I have done or what I should do.
Yeah. There might be some other, because like we said, we kind of operate up on the level 3 for this podcast. There might be, you know, a bonus episode where we start to look at maybe more specific things in the game and the actual, like, narrative plot structure itself.
I mean, something I do want to mention, actually, what we have is kind of an optional thing, is the idea of, like, the ending being open or closed.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, I feel that the way the game presents itself, the journey the narrator takes and you as the player, is an arc that you could almost fit into a conventional three-act structure.
Yeah.
And that doesn't detract from the fact that the questions it asks are open.
Yeah.
But the story arc itself kind of has an ending for the narrator.
Yeah, I think that there is truth to that. Like, we do see the narrator make some realizations and voice those realizations.
Or not voice them.
But we also get to a point where, like, at the end of the game, you know, you've got the last game that Coda produced and you have the epilogue. And it's really unclear to me whether the end of Coda's last game was untouched, or if the narrator has, like, kind of influenced that. You've got the epilogue. Is that the game that the narrator's created, or is it, like, you know, something that's kind of transcending that idea? That, and so I don't really know exactly where the narrator lands. I think it's an open ending, ultimately. I do think you're right, where you can clearly see the progression of the narrator, but where the narrator actually finishes is ambiguous to me.
Oh.
And when you get to that end, where you step into the whisper drive a second time, and the first time where you step into that and look and start to float up, and you've got the narrator saying, like, oh, look, when you take a step back, you can see something bigger. You can see the game as a whole. You can see the works as a whole. That's how we're going to look at Coda. And there's that one part of the original whisper drive where you've got the maze.
Yeah.
And when you look at that maze, the solution to it is instantaneously recognizable from above. And you get the bookended maze at the end, which is that infinite labyrinth that's impossible to comprehend and understand. Is that a conclusion that the narrator has come to, or is that the point that Coda is trying to make, or is that, you know, like, there's just so much that's still up in the air there.
That's true. Okay. I agree.
Mm.
But whenever I think of, I guess when I think of texts, I always just end them. I just staple that stuff, and I see the arc of the people.
Yeah.
I'm always focused around that kind of the people.
Mm.
And so I can kind of be blind to a lot of the later experiences the arc itself can do. So when, to me, the narrator has his narrative end and stops talking to you, it's like, that's when I cease, and then it's merely reflection.
The book is closed at that point as far as our ability to access that story. I definitely agree to you there. Like, it's not ambiguous. If you think that, like, the narrator actually is Davey Redden and all that kind of thing, then I guess maybe you would think it was completely open because, the real human being made those scripted realizations. But, I think that you're definitely right. Like, the narrator is done. We're not going to see a sequel.
The Beginner's Guide to Beginning Harder. Coda Strikes Back.
Yeah, fuck off. Like, anyway, I mean, I think that's pretty much everything we can say about The Beginner's Guide without just getting high and going for, like, 400 hours.
God, yeah. But, you know, join us next time for when we get high and do this for 400 hours.
We don't get high because marijuana is illegal in Australia. Neither of us have ever done it.
Also, I
encourage its use.
I also can't do crimes for work. So, neither here nor overseas.
It's very important that we understand that every single time John and I cop to anything that's even marginally besmirches our character, it's just a joke.
Yes. We're not that exciting.
Yes.
Sorry. We're both very
confused. I don't even drink.
I don't even know what drinking is.
Yeah.
I absorb everything through my skin.
I only drink milk. It's the only thing I drink.
But whose milk? That's the real question. Open-ended.
Soy milk. It's the most wholesome kind of milk.
Lord. I don't know. I think almond rice blend. That's the way I like to live my life.
Okay, so join us next time for our bonus episode, Best Kind of Milk.
Oh, yes.
Actually, if you know, fuck it. Maybe we should make that a fucking stretch goal. John and David debate the best kind of milk.
I do have 10 minutes. I have a lot of opinions on different kinds of milk.
Yeah.
Also, someone who doesn't drink the milk of animals anymore, which is how I'm going to phrase
that. Actually, now that makes that episode really unseemly.
Well.
Because I'm just sitting there like, my favorite milk is the one that involves torture.
I never said that. You said that. Oh boy.
Anyway, so that's basically all we're going to say about The Beginner's Guide for now.
Totally. If you want to talk about how we talked about this, feel free to reach out to us.
Yes, definitely. One of the other things that we should mention, obviously, as we're heading out of the show here, is all of our contact stuff is fully up and running now.
Yes.
So we are at SlowpokesCast on Twitter.
Yep.
We also have a website at slowpokespodcast.com where you can find all of this information.
Yeah.
We also have an email address, slowpokespodcast@gmail.com, and a Patreon, which is patreon.com/slowpokescast. So if you do want to support the show beyond just sharing and passing it around, that's a great place to go.
Basically, head to our website.
We have everything there. I did some work on it. Yay! So you may as well take a look. That is our shameless self-plugging. What game are we doing next time? Record Scratch. Hey, folks. So we've changed the release order in the episodes for the next coming up thing. So we're actually going to be doing...
We're going to be doing it in a new order, and Mass Effect is going to come out next.
Yes, the next episode will be Mass Effect, which is awesome. One of my favorite series. I played it literally like 13 or 14 times.
Yeah.
Although I wouldn't say it's like a landmark game, it is a big reference game. And so I'm very, very excited to see what you think of it, because you've never actually played Mass Effect before, right?
No. I have, like, I've started Mass Effect like 5 times, but I'm notorious for getting caught in the Citadel looking for keepers.
Yeah.
Where are the keepers? I can't find the keepers. Ah!
It's like 2/3 of my playtime is just on the Citadel. Yeah. But no, it'll be a lot of fun, because it'll be fun to see you actually finish that and see the game in full.
Totally.
Yeah, as I said, one of my favorite series, so I'm actually really excited to see what you think of it.
Yeah.
Like, once you have like real story content and stuff under your belt.
Totally. Like, everyone always talks about it. Everyone like talks about the whole series, every game that they've released, and with Andromeda coming out, I think this is like a great time to start talking about it.
Oh, I keep forgetting that's coming. That's in like 2 fucking weeks. Jesus Christ.
Yes. I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's literally like, I think it's 2 weeks from tomorrow or something as we're recording this now.
It's almost like we planned Mass Effect our episode to come out. Madness.
Almost. What an incredible coincidence. Anyway, yes, next time is Mass Effect. That'll be a lot of fun. Thank you guys all for joining us for the Beginner's Guide, and I hope you have an awesome in-between episodes.
Have a great one.